Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi. Your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you from our home studio here in Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. And I hope all the moms had a terrific Mother's Day. The mighty Aphrodite, who is mom to our two boys, got to put her feet up for a little while. She watched the Blue Jays baseball game with me and the twins. And tonight, just before the show, we watched The Horror of Dracula with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. I know, not exactly typical Mother's Day fare, but that's, well, we're just a little different, as you've probably already guessed. And a happy Mother's Day, of course, to my mom, Norma, who is going to be 96 years young next month, and she's doing well. However, she just lost her best friend, Joyce, who passed away this week, just shy of her 96th birthday. And get this, the two of them met in Sunday school back in the 1930s. They were best friends for nearly 90 years. And so happy Mother's Day, Mom. I love you. She's fast asleep. She likely won't hear this. You know, my mom has one of those smart speakers. It's a Google Nest. So she can listen to my podcasts and my weekly radio show and my new afternoon show. And I tell you, it's remarkable to see and hear my mom interact with this remarkable piece of technology. To think she grew up in a farmhouse with no indoor plumbing, no electricity. And here she is, well up into her 90s. She'll be sitting in the living room, and all of a sudden she'll call out, "Okay, Google, play Benny Goodman." All right. It's just truly fascinating to see this for me. Anyway, it's been quite a while since I've sat in on a coast-to-coast program on a Sunday night, and delighted to be here. I think we've got another good one for you as well tonight, this morning. Researcher, author, historian Jared Murphy joins me in the first half to discuss advanced technologies from prehistoric times. And if you haven't heard Jared speak before, you are in for a treat. In his book, It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, he presents a highly compelling case that it wasn't ancient aliens who were responsible for advanced technology that existed during the prehistoric era, but our own ancient relatives, a highly advanced human race that survived multiple catastrophes and to this day may live among us. Murphy points out towards various anomalies like the unexplained stone spheres in Costa Rica and the forbidden archaeology findings of Michael Cremo. Murphy also talks about the discovery of terra preta, an engineered soil made of biochar, which is ultra-fertile, regenerative, and could be a remnant of ancient civilizations. In the second half, academic Egyptologist historian David Elkington explores the acoustic connections between the earth, the human brain, and sacred places. He'll reveal how human writing in its original hieroglyphic form was a direct response to the divine sound patterns of sacred sites somehow. For example, recognizable hieroglyphics appear in sand patterns when sacred frequencies of the Great Pyramid are activated. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Self-experimenter and field researcher of ancient technologies and lost history, Jared Murphy has traveled the world searching for evidence of advanced ancestors and high technologies. He's the author of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History. Hey, Jared, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's good to speak with you, Richard, and I am very happy to be on with you tonight.
So it's an interesting journey this project, this book, actually started out as a piece of science fiction, nonfiction, or rather as a piece of fiction about this, I guess, a plot to sort of reanimate the world's oldest mummies, I guess the Paracas mummies, right? So tell me about how that project evolved into this work of nonfiction. It's not aliens, it's us.
Oh, it's great, and it's great because of a recent news story, but I will start at the beginning, which was I've been fascinated on the subject of quantum mechanics and physics and genetic engineering, and I've been following spintronics and quantum computing, and I thought it would be neat to write a story about clandestine military organizations reanimating the oldest mummies on Earth, and at the time, I had suspicions. I knew about the Mongolian mummified redheads that should have not been anywhere near Mongolia, but the Paracas came up as elongated skulled, single, suture-lined, I mean, physiologically different human beings that have never been genetically analyzed by what should be any academic institution interested in our history, but they haven't. And here it is. Brian Forster's done some work on it, but here we are with these mummies. And I thought militaries would reanimate them, and as I had explored the idea of collective human consciousness, that these mummies would reanimate and slowly, through genetic memory, reactivate and have maybe windows into ancient lost high technology that then these organizations would go out and find. And 3 days into my research, there is a documentary about Colonel Percy Fawcett, who was played by Brad Pitt in the movie The Lost City of Z.
Right, he's looking for this golden city in Brazil, sort of like the El Dorado story, really, but in South America.
Yeah, and Colonel Percy had done an extensive analysis of the Amazon basin for the British government, just doing a survey, and had found pottery shards and a lot of what he could tell were already ruins around just the Amazon basin. And he was going to go back, and quite begrudgingly, the American team had found Machu Picchu for his last trip back. He's with his son, he's lost in the Amazon, and it's a whole other story, but it started in this documentary. Here I'm 3 days into my research, and there's an archaeologist who takes this documentarian past a riverbank with about 12 feet of black soil. She pulls him over and says, well, we're about to go to the last village Colonel Percy Fawcett was ever seen at. And this is Terra Preta. It's an ancient engineered soil. And no one knows how to make it. It seems to self-replicate. It's been about 100 years of soil scientist research, but it's all over the Amazon basin. It's in North Africa. It's in Australia. It's in northern South America. We think it's in an area of Brazil at least twice the size of Spain or twice the size of Great Britain, but, oh, that's interesting. Now let's go look for a lost Colonel Percy Fawcett. And I'm like, hold on. Let me get this straight. I wanted to be Indiana Jones. I wanted to find mummies and get the girl and golden monkeys and statues. I didn't care about giant megalithic structures. I thought they were, as described to be by every natural history museum, loincloth people drag heavy stones everywhere, pound on rocks, and anything interesting. It's certainly not going to come down to sexy, engineered, ancient biocharred soil that self-replicates, has piezoelectric properties, and is all over the earth. And that is a problem, starting with the fact that, you know, they find Göbekli Tepe and they go, well, we don't know. Well, obviously it's the first of its kind. Well, because it's the first one you found and you've only dug it up 5%. Meanwhile, you now have an engineered soil that is not only the greatest growing soil for food on Earth, it filters heavy metals, it filters carbon dioxide, and it's everywhere that's been snapshotted and described as only nomadic and simple and Neolithic people have been. And then I end up spending 3.5 years, and this is 5 years ago now, and then 6 months editing for the actual book, I'm revising it right now, but the work took me from a work of fiction into a world that, starting with soil, and as you mentioned, stone spheres, which do not remotely get the credit they should for the resonance and the issues with all of how complex this science is. But full circle, I'm just going to bring up that my original point was to have scientists reanimating the Paracas, and you can't even make this up. A new article in Ancient Origins over the Russians wanting to reanimate 3,000-year-old warriors. That's literally the news 3 weeks ago. They want
my
to
word.
Reanimate 3,000-year-old, not only the warriors, but their horses, and create super soldiers. You can't make this up.
My word. Yeah, that's an entirely different show, Jared. We'll have to have you back just to talk about that. But, I mean, so it's interesting, as you point out, you're watching this documentary on Colonel Percy Fawcett, and they just kind of gloss over the fact that they've just uncovered this, what you call, terra preta, which is engineered soil. So what does that mean that it's engineered? Like, I know dirt isn't dirt. You've got compost and you've got different types of soils. But what do you mean that it's engineered?
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I'm thinking the same thing. You know, I'm smack dab in the middle of farm country in Minnesota, and I have family that's farmers. I understand the John Kelly Farm, the idea of crop rotation, that was developed here in Minnesota. It's part of the U of M system. I mean, I know soil, basically. You add nutrients, and that's simple. I didn't think it was really much more complex than that. And there is a number of hot topics around terra preta, because it's not just in Brazil. It's also in there's also, no joke, there's a black market for this, where they're selling it as a potting soil. And I came across it just in wanting to be paleo and wanting to grow nutrient-dense foods. Most of our foods are grown in sands or limited nutrients. So what they're doing with biochar is it's a combo of, if we were, for instance, going to have an apple farm, we would want to have a biochar that would work for growing apple trees or growing grapes or growing wheat. But what they've done is they've created a modern application of biochars where what they're finding is tweaking, at least mimicking to the best they can, creating a soil mixture that includes charcoals that are from woods, from other plant bases. And this is not a simple thing. In the time that this was really, really modern scientific interest in this really began with a Dutch scientist named Wim Sombroek. And he published in 1966. And really, yes, when this archaeologist was showing it to this documentarian, hey, you know, terra preta is like really thick, the Amazon was considered a wet jungle, a wet desert. So it's a jungle, but it grew trees, but it wasn't good for growing soil. So somehow, based on even evidences, part of the hot topic of this is that carbon-14 dating has put this soil at a minimum to 7,000 years old. And it's been used the entire time. So it has different dates. It's been
In other words, the nutrients aren't being depleted, which is why you rotate crops typically, because the nutrients get leached out of the soil just through growing plants. You're saying that this is regenerative.
Yes. And it's filtering heavy metals, so like contents that would be in fertilizers. It's filtering carbon dioxide, you know, it's a charcoal. But if the entire earth, I mean, there's a lot of questions. For instance, side note is, If there are man-made biochars on every continent, because Chernozems are another one, and they're in North America, they're in many, many places that do not have a snapshot of advanced or modern human occupancy beyond nomadic peoples or no significant sizes or populations that would account for these biochars being on every continent. And most importantly, even if we just stick with terra preta, this Portuguese word for black soil is the identical recipe is in Northern Africa, South America, and in Brazil and in Central America. And there's a similar one in Middle Australia. So and we're finding this even in DNA and evidence with Denisovans being in the South Pacific. That's made recent news. But we are seeing that there was much more of a travel culture via sea, not just a land bridge, a land-based society, this terrible archaic Victorian image of travel, that there was seafaring peoples, and there's no other way to explain how this ancient engineered soil ends up in North Africa and also ends up in South America. And its limits aren't just to the fact that it's the richest self-sustaining growing soil on Earth, and it filters heavy metals, and it has these piezoelectric properties. But there are scientists that have been working out seismic metamaterials, which I won't dig into it completely right now, but the idea is that by sifting soils, managing soil itself can contribute to the seismic metastructures of buildings. So ancient megalithic structures, not just stone spheres using as a wave resonator, which we can get into, it means that they were using the polygonal megalithic construction, the stone spheres, all the way down to golf ball size, found in Costa Rica, found in the Arctic Circle. I have a world map of this. I had recently just did a presentation about this at America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire, and this map shows that these stone spheres are everywhere. They're even in
When you say spheres, it's like they've been, they look like, I mean, they are solid rock, but it looks like they've been machined, like placed on a giant lathe. They are perfect, yeah. Spheres, right?
No, that's what's interesting. So some people like to point out, oh, they're perfect spheres. Well, later people have been pointing out, well, they're not perfect spheres. And some of them aren't, but one, they've been weathering for tens of thousands of years, because it's either, a lot of people have concerned themselves with the Younger Dryas, that we've nailed down that 11.5 to 13,000 years ago there was a massive cataclysm. But there was a supervolcano that goes off, and we got it pretty well narrowed into 74 to 75,000 years.
Toba.
And there's a city off the coast of Cuba that I like to reference that, based on a number of ups and downs, so we have Lake Titicaca, 12,600 feet, with a saltwater lake and seahorses. We have the Rikat structure, or the Eye of Africa in North Africa, at 7,600 feet above, but it also shows signs of being at sea level. Then we have a 2,300 foot deep below the ocean, pyramid-styled city under and off the coast of Cuba, and all of it either is because of the cataclysm, and one theory is static plate shifting, that the massive amount of water caused some stuff to go up and some stuff to go down. But we've concerned ourselves with the picture and the paradigm. I want to just throw it out there for everyone that we're looking at a highly advanced human society that likely was here and well-established. The city off the coast of Cuba could not have been above water less than 50,000 years ago, and more likely maybe associated with that supervolcano eruption. The reality is that we're looking at a worldwide, consistently and similar building with stone spheres, which are hollow, have multiple layers, are up to, they found one in Bosnia that's 64 tons, and they're as small as golf balls. And what's interesting is that if you're dealing with Egan values, if you're dealing with waves, frequencies, energies, then you're dealing with stone spheres that not only have to have an external structure that mimics wave resonation, that mimics as a seismic wave, it's either going to mute a wave or it's going to increase a wave. What you're looking for is it's a wave shield, and depending on the size of the sphere, and the this is something that's never been done. One, we need to test everywhere around the world for engineered soils, but if you sift the soil the right way and you use stone spheres, place them not under a single building even, but under whole villages or towns or whole super cities, these work as inertial resonators, shielding infrastructure from earthquakes, and we're talking under 10 hertz. We're talking, there are modern experiments.
That's pretty advanced technology. We're kind of touching on a lot of different things here. I want to come back to the engineered soil itself, which is pretty fascinating. People say, well, dirt, that's not very exciting. But when, as you describe, it has piezoelectric qualities, which suggests what? That it could have been used for communication?
Yeah, or, so not only are you worried about, whether there's an earthquake, you have buildings that are polygonal shaped that are connecting on all sides. And one of the corresponding features is keystone cuts. Well, why are they always working in quartz, which is exactly what's in the computers, our cell phones, everything we're using has a quartz crystal. And why is it that they're using buildings that are consistently made out of basalt?
Okay, Jared, I got to jump in here. We're going to take a quick time out. We'll come back and discuss further. Jared Murphy, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Jared Murphy is with us, self-experimenter, field researcher of ancient technologies and lost history, and the author of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, Discovering Our Lost History. We're talking about this terra preta, this engineered soil, which is, what, on the order of 5,000-6,000 years old, according to some carbon dating. And the idea that it was engineered and that it is found from Brazil to the Crimea, Australia, Africa. So what were they doing with this soil? Was it a large, like, industrial farming that was going on here? Why did they use so much of it?
I think that's a really central question to understanding how better to paint a more accurate picture of our ancient high technology past. NASA sorted out how to work aerosoled nutrients called aeroponics by atomizing water down to 30 to 50 microns. You could supply plants with nutrients to grow in space without having to carry too much water. And I do think as we've begun to 3D print meat and 3D print cellular structures, that we need to reevaluate the way any advanced society would manage food. And we have carbon dating, but what we don't have is it's the depths of the carbon dating that we need to look at, because some of this terra preta is like 12, it can be up to almost 20 feet thick. And if they weren't just using it, so let's just say that there was another system for producing food, including something maybe beyond 3D printing. But at the same time, what else would they do? And that part of that is answered with the stone spheres and the polygonal construction and that energy transfer. And one of it is there are recent papers that came out, thank God, just prior. There have been European researchers looking at this and the stone spheres, Greco-Roman amphitheaters, and what they found was that there is also a negative refraction, even lensing or cloaking, taking place with soft soils. And what that happens is that using a particular very closely shaped to the waves and frequencies, you're either trying to amplify, mute, or cloak, or resonate, or hit that antechamber within the stone spheres because they're hollow. They've been busted into from New Zealand to Europe to Central America because at some point somebody thought there was gold in them, so they've been dynamited and hacked and picked open. So we know that they're hollow, many of them, and we don't have a material science research. So for the soil to contain these stone spheres and the soil itself to have refracting and lensing and cloaking by the very density of the soil, I think one of the things that's happening is that you could send a signal for communication directly to a building, or we already know through, paleo and a number of other health and movement just in the last 10 years that have become so popular that we have an electron exchange when we walk barefoot on the earth. And we take it for granted, what we call in quotes nature, that XYZ, a tree, bird, animal, that it's all random, that there wasn't an intentional design, and at some point engineered to the point where the spacing of trees, which is pointed out in some of these scientific research, that they sorted out that the city of Bologna, Italy, and the tall towers would create safe zones. So by using structures above ground, by using soft, sifted, I want to describe it in a way that people can think of like baking when you sift flour, but imagine either compacting or loosening soil over periods of distances and depths using stone spheres, keystone cuts within polygonal megalithic construction, and all of it managing catastrophe over tens of thousands of years, managing celestial impacts, managing terrifying scalar weapons that we, you know, even if it was a worldwide society, we can't assume that they either got along or that there weren't stressful points amongst the people themselves and how they managed disease or infection or anything that could have happened that was unexpected to a society that may have, in the slivers of truths that remain, maybe an indefinite lifespan with the ability to cure and or eliminate, or using frequencies and energies, eliminate even things like
that. So these were super conscious individuals, our ancestors.
Yes, and we have, well, and you and I have talked about this before. There are so many places to go with this. You have to ask me where do you want to go?
Well, I wanted to just come back to these giant spheres for a minute, because you're saying that they were used maybe in part to mute the effects of an earthquake. So which leads me to the question, how large were these polygonal structures? Were they building like skyscrapers that they had to be so concerned with earthquakes?
And that's something that I've really tried to address more recently, even in recent lectures and in conversations, is exactly that point, is that when you look at these polygonal walls, like Sacsayhuaman, when you're looking at these large, what appears to be, you know, 800-ton down to 20-ton or 5-ton multi-sided polygonal blocks that everyone goes on about, you know, you can't fit a piece of blade of grass or a piece of paper or a pin between them, and they're almost marshmallowed together, and they've studied, at least even in standard academia, that they work well with earthquakes. But there's this assumption. What's missing is all the ancillary technology, not only to cut and shape and measure, whether it be earthquake or communication frequencies and technologies, because we're finding Egan values, pi, we're finding that in everything from ziggurats to the Great Pyramid to other constructions, that they're very much using the math for a frequency energy-based construction, right down to the mixings of the particular stones for currents and properties. And the machinery is missing that would have built those blocks. And once the blocks are built, we assume, okay, well, if they have the cutting abilities and the measuring abilities and the precision to do that, what we're missing is, after thousands or tens of thousands of years of reappropriation or dusting and rusting and just recycling of materials, we're left with the stone. But what we don't see, like we see today in modern construction, is the 10 stories, literally up to 10 stories of wood, that the entire base, these megalithic structures, two very important things that I know, it's not sexy mummies, it's sexy soil, but we're missing the fact that there's massive structures that could have been iron and wood, and if they can work with 1,000 or 1,200-ton stones like at Baalbek, they can certainly work with trees like Hyperion, redwoods that are 60 feet in diameter and are 380 feet tall. They would very much have the ability to cut and move and manage and use these foundations to build these structures to who knows how many stories, and out of metal and wood and other larger materials. But below,
just think of the engineering principles that they had. I mean, you mentioned pi, and so we think of, well, when did Archimedes live? I mean, he's credited with discovering pi, right? Archimedes,
right, but,
and this is what,
right,
thousands of years before Archimedes.
Yeah, and we have the Babylonian Plimpton. We have the Plimpton tablet, which is showing Pythagoras's work, almost 1,000 years before him, and what looks like to scholars as a teaching tablet. The Babylonian Plimpton tablet looks more like not just that somebody was scratching out and working out the Pythagorean theorem and all of it, but more like, hey, this is my aid tablet for my classroom, and I'm going to teach off of it. So, and then they have another base 60 math, a hexagonal math system that it's spherical math that if you were working like with giant stone spheres and you wanted to create a math system that was going to help you with unlimited, unending waves and frequencies, you need to understand Egan values. You need to understand and work with waves and frequencies. You need to have math that supports it. If you're building a giant machine that uses and creates energy and or communication, you need to understand Egan values. And it's built in everything from, and this gets us back to the soil. Underneath these megalithic structures, people look for gold and jewelry. And my greatest fascination as a old historical home and large building remodeler, I'm looking at the foundations themselves. Why, after even dynastic periods of 6,000 years, are megalithic polygonal walls still straight and level outside of earthquakes? The foundations themselves in a modern home is only a couple of feet thick. We're talking about constructions, billions of tons of rock that have been finely cut in ways we don't understand to support structures that are gone, built on foundations that could be 20, 30, 40 feet thick and pre-compacted under, no one's ever analyzed the actual foundations of these polygonal buildings.
Right, because as you say, everyone's interested in finding a statue and putting it in a museum, and that's our history, but we're literally ignoring the dirt under our feet. And it may not sound exciting, but as you're discovering, it's everything. Let me ask you this, and we'll have to carry this part of the conversation into the next hour, of course, but why did you, after seeing this evidence, why does it necessarily point to our highly advanced ancestors and not aliens, as our ancient alien devotees would have us believe?
It does, because as we get into it, like you said, in the next hour, it was easier based on our upbringing to think that it was an entity from somewhere else. When you look at a single piece of the technology of the ancient past, when you've grown up, like I've grown up, going to natural history museums, and everyone 50,000 years ago was banging rocks together in a loincloth, but that's your image. And clearly, you know, we've held on to a science only in the theory of evolution and in the theory of our history that was written by Victorian authors. If we held on and related to our technologies that we're literally speaking to each other on now, we wouldn't have cell phones. If we were holding on to the theory of cell phone, a rotary dial of technology, if we related to everything, and unfortunately, like you said, like Michael Cremo's work, he points out if you have facts that don't fit the theories, academia is severely guilty of throwing out the facts so that only the facts that are tabled fit the theories. And when you start with the engineered soil, it became an avalanche over 3 years to see that the math, the science, and everything that adds up to what is a frequency, energy, highly advanced society that even in our genes and our genetic codes are showing that this whole system worked together, that electrons chain exchange between our feet and the ground isn't just, oh, you know, you're getting rid of some bad ions and you're realigning your magnetic field. No, we have a very particular magnetic field that when you do that exchange on soil that has been terraformed for communication, there's a good chance that you didn't need a cell phone. There's a good chance that you could use your pineal gland. You could use abilities like synesthesia, a number of other genetic abilities, collective human consciousness, and communicate, connect, taste, sense, feel, speak with your neighbor, and simultaneously not use 15 or 10% of your consciousness level, but maybe use 90 or 80 or 100% and be connecting with the structures themselves and the within the blades of grass that you're actually walking between. It actually relates. I don't know how much time we have up against the break, but
we've got about 3 minutes, and we've got about 3 minutes here.
Oh, great. Okay, so that can slow me down then. This goes into homeopathy, where in the late 1700s, they start figuring out how to mimic and create cures using plant-based medicines. And really, this is all vibrational medicine. And we're not talking woo-woo and Chris. I'm not just making up fairies and angels, and that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the actual tinctures that were created, the more that they diluted the remedies, the more a positive effect. So at first, it was crush up 1 million plants, make a tincture out of an essential oil, swallow it and have a health benefit that they developed over to create cures. But what they found was eventually when you diluted it even 1,000 times, the vibrational frequency of that medication, and there's been so much experimentation about this, it had a more powerful effect. And I think that there was a point where we were so tuned to our environment that being in the presence of the vibrational frequencies of the plants, the soil, and what you were actually walking through, you did not need to actually crush or ingest an object to obtain that frequency benefit. You had to be present to it. And I don't mean conscious of it like you're one with the plant, but in a sense, that frequency tuning, in our minds, it'll be very different than Dr. Anthony Holland's work, who killed MRSA and leukemia and a number of bacteria, over 30, and viruses with sound and frequency, picking up Royal Rife's work, and there's even a TED Talk. I mean, he did it in 2008. You can go look it up, and you can watch him killing MRSA, leukemia, and a number of other viruses and bacteria with sound.
And right, we're going to take a time out here. We're up against the top of the hour, Jared. When we come back, we'll try and discover who our ancestors were that were responsible for creating these engineered soils and these structures that muted the effects of earthquakes and so much more. Was it the Neanderthals? Was it the Denisovans? Was it the Paracas? We'll get back to the Paracas. Oh yes, can't leave them. We'll do all of that. Jared Murphy stays with us. We'll open up the phone lines as well at the bottom of the hour.